Hello, welcome to another episode of the Indie Founder Podcast, the podcast about what it's really like to bootstrap a company. My name is Tiago, I am an indie maker, and in this show I share my own journey as an entrepreneur, and I interview other indie makers like the one I have here with me today. His name is Craig Hewitts, and he's the founder of Castos, a hosting service for podcasters. Before we get started though, if you like this type of content, make sure to give it a 5-star review. If you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple, just scroll up and click on the 5 stars. And if you're listening to this on YouTube, make sure to give it a thumbs up and as well to subscribe to the channel. There are a lot of other amazing interviews in my catalog, so just make sure to go and see the old episodes. You'll find for sure a lot of knowledge there. Now, without any further ado, here's Craig. Craig, welcome to the Indie Founder Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Craig, so you are the founder of Castos, which is a hosting service for podcasters. It's an interview that I'm quite excited about because it's very much in the same space where PodSqueeze lives. So there's a lot of knowledge that I will be taking as well for me. And then we met before, we already had some chats, but I think you have a lot of insight. So you started with an agency called Podcast Motor that then you converted into a SaaS. You went through Tiny Seed, the accelerator for bootstrapped companies by Rob Walling, who I also had here in the show. I love Rob. He's so smart. I think he's doing amazing things here for the podcasting world, for the bootstrapping world and for the podcasting world too. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, today I want to talk about that, about the fact that you lived in France and the US and what is the difference between that. I want to talk about podcasting and the podcasting market. And also you raised a tiny round and then you raised another round. So like how that affected the whole thing. Yeah. So that's kind of the menu for today. And yeah, what do you think? Good?
Yeah. And I want to talk to you about like running an AI company because, you know, AI is the topic du jour. And so, you know, I think we do a bit of it. And I'd love to just kind of compare notes on how we're thinking about AI because I think, you know, any real business topic or conversation these days isn't complete without the consideration of what AI means to what we're doing now and how we're tooling and what customers expect. Maybe that's the biggest difference I've seen is like what customers expect now versus pre-ChatGPT from any kind of SaaS.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, AI is something that has been giving me a bit of anxiety as well because I use AI now in every aspect of my life, not only business, but especially for business, for writing code. My designer co-founder is now our senior developer somehow. So it also scares me a little bit on how, like, it seems that we are always one OpenAI release away or Claude release away of somehow losing our business. So that scares me a little bit. But yeah, I think that's definitely some interesting topics to talk about. But let's start from the beginning. So how did you get into podcasting and when did you decide to start this agency, Podcast Motor?
Yeah, so I had just had my second child, my son, and was working a regular kind of corporate job. I was in sales and traveling a lot. I was in like medical sales. And so it's a different model in the US. All the hospitals are private. And so you go and you travel to this hospital and this hospital and this hospital and try to sell stuff. And I was like leaving the house at 5 o'clock in the morning, getting home at 7 o'clock at night, and had a 2-year-old and a newborn. And I was like, this is terrible. Like, this is not like what I want to be designing my life around and towards. And like, I just got to do something different. And so I started very much like a nights and weekends thing. Actually, around that time for about a year and a half, I had a podcast with a guy named Ken Wallace, and it was called the Nights and Weekends Podcast. It was just two dudes like making it happen nights and weekends. And so, you know, the nice thing about a productized service, like I still advocate for it really heavily with folks who are just getting started, is it's so easy to get started. It's literally just put up a page, not even a page, just like you get a doc and a Stripe account and you can go make a few thousand dollars like pretty easily. And that's basically what we did. You know, I pinged a few of my friends, Brian Castle, Brennan Dunn, I think Rob Walling, like we talked about, put out some kind of like recommendations for me. And Yeah, I mean,
and you had the sales background, right? So you were good at getting these first clients, right?
I was and still am pretty good at sales, and had just started a podcast of my own. So I have a podcast called Rogue Startups, where we talk just about startups and business and entrepreneurship. And so I was editing my own show using Audacity, recording using Ecamm from Skype. Like, you might not remember that, but that's how we did it back in the day.
What was the year that we're talking about?
2013.
2013. Yeah, it's kind of the beginning of podcasting, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, on the hosting side, it was like Libsyn, Blueberry. Mm-hmm. I think Zencaster had just come out, or Zencast had just come out. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Like, there was no Castos, there was no Transistor, there was no Captivate, there was no any of that stuff. Maybe probably Blueberry or Buzzsprout.
Right.
So anyways, like, started this product I service called Podcast Motor, and we scaled it up to like 10 or 20,000 a month. Pretty quick.
Oh,
hired
wow.
like a couple editors, like a project manager. I was taking sales calls like in between regular stuff for my day job and in the evening and in the morning.
And you still had your day job going on?
Still had my day job for about a year and a half, up to the point where, and this is the beautiful thing about like a project guy service, you can have your day job and you can be making money on the side, and you can reinvest all that money that you're making on the side back in the business. So we were doing a ton of content. We were doing a bunch of marketing. I was paying myself a little bit, but I was also saving a ton of money personally. Mm-hmm. So I could then just go quit my job and had years of expenses saved up.
Right. And what kind of services did you provide it? So it's editing, is it recording, all of that, right?
Yeah. So it's, you know, interestingly, pretty similar to what we do today, except we added on like video and video shorts, but it's audio at the time. It was just audio and show notes and publishing. Okay. Today, it's audio, video, short clips, a bunch of different written assets using AI for a lot of it, and publishing. So literally, you could record this, send us this link, and we do everything else.
Got it. And how did you get these first clients? Were you just like, what is the process to get a B2B client like those?
Yeah, I think that we all make it way more complicated than it has to be. I literally probably emailed or Slack definitely didn't exist. I don't even know. Like, I just emailed probably or pinged in like a community, a few of my friends and like network. And they were like, that had podcasts. And they were like, yeah, that'd be great. You know, at the time it was like $250 a month. And we're like $1,500 a month now. So we're like quite a bit more expensive. So like it's a no-brainer. Even back then, 12 years ago, it was a no-brainer. If you're like a business person and you want to have a podcast, but you don't want to do the editing, it's a no-brainer to pay somebody to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think here I would already like to introduce the difference between selling this, because your first clients were American, right?
Yeah.
I assume most of them.
Yeah.
And you lived in France for how many years?
5.5 years. Yeah.
Okay. So quite a bit. So you have a good understanding between the difference, and I bet you that you have a lot of amazing stories to tell. But do you reckon that the way you acquire custom clients for in the US is different? Like, the approach would be different for in Europe and in France?
It's impossible for me to say, like, if I were a French person acquiring customers in France,
okay,
would it be different? As an expat, 100%, right? Because, like, I spoke pretty good French, but, like, not natively. So, like, I would never, you know, the analogy these days would be, like, I think the easiest way for anyone to make money is just walk into your local whatever business and say, hey, do you want AI services? And they're all going to say yes. And you just charge them money for it. Like, that's the easiest way to make money these days. I definitely could never have done that in France, because, like, I spoke pretty good French, but it was really obvious that I wasn't a native speaker.
You think that makes a difference, not being native, not sharing the same nationality?
I do. I don't know if it matters to them. It definitely mattered to me, because I just wouldn't have felt comfortable coming in and pitching and having the confidence to have like a dynamic conversation and really deeply understand the customer's pain point, and especially with something like AI consulting. Like, you really have to understand, like, oh, we're a manufacturing company and we have these workflows and we have these logistics and this is our problem. Like, you know how it is. Like, in another language, That's no, really I totally hard.
Know. I totally know. And we are the reason why I'm asking this is because here in Portugal has been quite, I would not say easy because there's always long sales cycles, but it has been, we were able to close a few deals with big companies here in Portugal, big media companies. And it's very hard to do the same outside, even within Europe and US. And it's weird because the approach should be the same, exactly what you said. Like, we reach out to a person, we try to find research who's the person that would kind of champion PodSqueez in the company, and reach out to them and we say, hey, this is what we provide. Are you interested? And it works here in Portugal, but it's not the same. First, we don't get answers. And even if we have a few meetings, and it's funny because even in Brazil, we tried, which is they also speak Portuguese, but even then, I feel that it's harder. So that's why I was asking, and do you have any solution for this? Like, how would you expand into, like, would you just hire someone from that country, from that market, or would you learn it, everything there is to know about their business culture?
You know, I think, it's a hard question.
It is.
I also think that, like, I, as a American native English speaking person, have an advantage just because, you know, English is the kind of universal language of business. You know, it's not Portuguese. And so, like, you go somewhere and people are going to speak Portuguese or German or Italian or French or English.
Right.
And so, like, how I would tackle it. So if you're like, hey, Craig, you have to go into the French market. Yeah, I would hire a French person.
Okay.
I think did you do that already?
Did you ever try that? Okay.
No, and like, but I also don't think that's like the best question almost. It is like, I think I've never understood companies saying like, we're going to enter the US market or we're going to enter the French market. Like, you already have customers there, 100%. Like, we have customers in, 100 countries. And we've never made a concerted effort to go into Ireland, right? Or whatever. It just happens. Like, our customer acquisition is universal. Like, the only language on our website is English. Could we, you know, universal, like, internationalize it, localize it? Yeah. Would that help? I don't know. It would be a lot of work.
We did that, actually, with PodSqueez.
Yeah.
We used the AI. We used the GPT to translate everything.
Yeah.
And we are ranking quite well. There are certain, like in Arabic, for instance, we are ranking on top on like audio and answer.
Mm.
And like, I don't understand what is written there. I hope it's correct. It seems to be working. But
are
I just
getting customers from it?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And French as well. And Portuguese as well. In Brazil, we are ranking quite well. So it's actually something that even it's funny. Do you have your pricing in other currencies or is it only dollar?
Yeah, no, it's just dollars. Yeah.
We switch ours because, you know, dollar was going down quite a bit and we get paid in dollars, but we spend it in euros, right? So we saw like a huge decrease on our euro MRR. So we said, okay, we need to do something. Because we have clients in Europe. Most of our, like 50% of our clients are still in the US, but then we have clients in Brazil, Europe, India, a lot of UK. So we said, no, let's get all these different currencies because then at least we have, it's a way to decrease the risk of only depending on one currency. So we did that. Plus, we translated the website. And now with AI, it was very easy to do that. We just have to have the repo structure to do it. And then now every time, it takes a bit longer to now release a new feature, but now with AI, I just say, hey, by the way, translate this into all the languages I have on my files, and it just does that, and it works really well.
Yeah. Are you using like a service for that, or is it just plugging into ChatGPT directly, or what?
Cursor.
Yeah, Cursor just does it.
Yeah, I have my translation files in my repo. Like, I have a key for each UI string.
Mm-hmm.
And I have like JSON. It's a very simple approach. JSON files everywhere. And I just tell it, hey, go through the files, see the languages I have, and like translate. And it does it. So these days, I think it's worth it because it just opens this SEO. Obviously, that we have like Japanese, we have I think it was Vietnamese. Suddenly we started having like clients from Vietnam. Not a lot.
Wow. Yeah.
But we do have like a few markets, like, and most of our traffic now, or a big chunk of our traffic, is coming from the keyword audio and answer in Arabic.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
So it's. We took here a sidetrack, but I think it's definitely something that I would recommend.
Yeah.
But we're talking about sales, talking about, so you said, okay, if I want to get into a different market, I would probably hire, especially B2B, because you said, okay, you probably have clients all around the world, and we do, but I think those are more like smaller clients, clients that don't have like long sales cycles. Whereas, at least for me now, to close these deals here in Portugal, I've been dealing with this for months, right? So it takes a long time. But I agree. I think that it's like hiring someone, if we had the funds to do that, it's definitely something we would do. So let's talk and let's move forward a bit to the transition between Podcast Motor and Castos, right? So maybe first, I already kind of introduced what Castos is, but would you mind doing like a quick pitch for the listeners? What is Castos and how does Castos compete with the other hosting services?
Yeah, so Castos is a podcast hosting platform. So you would use us to host your podcast and distribute it to Apple and Spotify and all these places, get analytics and monetize your podcast. We do public and private podcasts. And the way we got started was from one of our customers at Podcast Motor. They emailed, his name is Brad Tunard. He was a big WordPress guy, sold a bunch of his plugins to WP Engine a few years ago. Brad was a customer of ours and said, hey, I have a friend who owns this podcasting plugin and he's going to work at Automattic. He wants to sell the plugin. Maybe you want to buy it and you can get into, you know, software and product that way. I was like, sure, I'll take a look. And the podcast or the plugin's called Seriously Simple Podcasting. We still own it. We still run it. It's still a huge part of our business. And so we acquired the plugin. It was a free plugin with a couple of add-ons, all free. And we built the SaaS platform to integrate with it. And so if anyone's familiar with Blueberry and their PowerPress plugin, it works very similarly, or it just works better, I think. But we saw the Blueberry model. We're like, hey, like they do this. We can just do it, but better. And I think like as a side note, anybody getting into SaaS or any kind of product, like you should never reinvent the wheel. Like just take what's already working and do it a little better. Like steal like an artist is the book, right? Is like the expression. Mm-hmm. Like take something, you guys did this, right? You took something that's already happening and maybe like applied it to a new market, right? Like we took an existing business model and way to go to market and just said like, hey, we can just do it better. I don't think that's wrong at all. Like there are these huge companies out
there. That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Huge companies out there. Like HubSpot is not the first ever CRM, right? But like it's pretty darn successful.
So do you mean that a good way to start your SaaS is to find something that is working for one market and then apply the same for another market? Or do you mean just find something that is working that has a huge market and just go and try to do it better?
Either. Yeah.
Okay.
And it just, the which you pick just depends on which is the bigger opportunity.
Right. How do you measure that? The which one is the biggest opportunity?
Yeah. I mean, there's probably like scientific ways to do it. For us, it was just like opportunity. Like the only reason we did this is because we thought we would have an unfair advantage in having a distribution channel that's built in and a lot of trust already. Like the plugin was very popular and we could then monetize that channel. That's the only reason that we started the business. Well, it's about the only reason we started the business. And the only reason it made sense, because otherwise you start from scratch. You know how it is. Like you got to build an audience and the product and the marketing.
Distribution is hard, right? These days, I think building product, especially with AI, is fast and the no-code tools. But building the distribution, that takes a lot of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's definitely the issue here. So explain to me how this plugin work. So I have a WordPress website and I have a podcast, right? So that would be the target customer. And then I can install the plugin into my website so that people can listen to my podcast within my website. Is that what it does?
Yep. Yeah. So it creates like an area on your website. It's called a custom post type in WordPress, where like you have a blog and you have a podcast section. So they're separate. It creates the RSS feed. So people can and still do use it entirely for free. So just install the plugin, host the files on your server, like your WordPress server. Okay. And then you can host your podcast for free on your website. So people who are like really into like, I want all this on my own turf, like I want control, they love it, right? Because it's like, you can never take that RSS feed away from them. So you host the RSS feeds.
You control that.
You can. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And then, okay. And then our customers at Castos, then the few big value props are file storage and distribution. Like you upload the files to us and we handle all the file storage and distribution. So you don't have if you get a popular podcast, you don't have like a $500 bill a month from WP Engine, which is what would happen.
Got it.
We give a bunch of analytics that you just can't get from WordPress and monetization.
Wow. And
so you can do the core of what you need with a podcast for free with a plugin. But if you want like the real way to do it, like we're recording this on Zencastr, we could use Zoom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it would be bad, but it would work.
Yeah.
Or you can level up and do like the right way. And that's just kind of how we position it.
Got it. So you got this plugin that was already working, and then you combine that with your knowledge in the podcasting industry plus and your clients, right? So I guess you used your distribution right away to start selling this plugin to your clients. That's right.
Yeah. I mean, distribution we had from three places, I guess. One was we had customers at Podcast Motor. Two is we'd been doing content marketing and SEO from like day zero. Oh no, I have the reactions on.
I love
that's
it.
It's terrible. So
it's a hoot getting people on.
Right. So customers at Podcast Motor had been doing content marketing and SEO for a long time. And that was, you know, in those days, a really good way to acquire customers. And then we had like 15,000 free users of the plugin. And so one day we just released the new version of the plugin. It had this upsell to the paid hosting version, and that's how we got customers.
Oh, wow. And that's how you started your SaaS, basically. You just released it, and yeah, that's incredible. So you are not coding guy, right? Like you're sales, marketing. So how did you manage like doing the coding and so on? Like, did you ask someone from your team? Did you learn how to code? How is that?
No, I definitely don't know how to code. And that was, you know, when I have these kind of conversations, it's always the biggest challenge that we had is how to talk to developers. You know, as a non-technical person, how I relay what is in my head to what the business needs and the product that I want the developers to build was really challenging. And, you know, our first developer, a guy named Jonathan Bossinger, amazing developer, really good person, still friends, but he had never like really built SaaS before and probably never worked with a client like me and like building a product. Like he'd done a bunch of consulting, but never really, like he came from the WordPress world. And so I think he and I kind of grew together a lot in how we communicate and how we scope things. Mm-hmm. Like these days, it would be so different because I would just fire up, you know, V0 or whatever and talk to it and say, okay, here is the thing. Go build a thing just like this. But we didn't have that for a long time. We hired a designer about 2 years in probably. And that was really transformational because I could then talk to the designer and he would translate the words that I use into UI in Figma. And then, you know, the developers could implement that.
It's crazy now looking back and how complex it was to build a tool. And now with this, you know, AI-based tools, so much easier, right?
Yeah.
You can just describe what you want. And yeah, back then, you're absolutely right. It was, I guess, a big investment as well from your side to get this up and running, right?
Yeah, huge. I mean, you know, full-time developer, multiple developers, full-time designer. Until just recently, like we've been able to reduce our team by like half, which is not a trivial thing. Like as a founder, like that's the hardest thing any founder has to do. It's like, hey, imagine. Like you're an amazing person, but we just don't need you anymore. Is a really hard conversation. But like as it relates to AI, like that's 100% the reality. Is like you can build like I do a bit of coaching these days, and I coach founders. And I was talking to a very successful founder, growing like 50% a year. And they were saying, like, I think we can be like a $5 million a year company with three people.
Yeah.
I was like, 100% you can. Like, the product's there. You need you as a founder doing marketing and a little bit of product. You need a developer and you need a support person. Maybe Absolutely. You need a full-time marketer, but I don't even know what a full-time marketer would do these days.
Mm.
Like, they would just, yeah. like with AI, I mean, just think like 11 Labs and HeyGen and all the shit you can do with Claude and Manus and all that. Like, they would be creating so much content and doing so much. I think it would outrun the ability to like impact the market.
Yeah, I think now these days you just, the most valuable skill is knowing what to create, what to do, not really the doing part, right? So as a marketeer, you need to know what you want and how to achieve, because I can be creating a lot of content that produces zero, right? So it's also like what type of content to create. But you are absolutely right. I think there is a huge impact with AI in all fields, but development fields is definitely one. I mean, to be honest, for us, it was actually the same. We had a freelancer working with us for almost a year as a developer. And we reached a point, like, and helped us a lot to develop Postgres, but we reached a point where my co-founder, João, which is a designer, but he also kind of knows how to do HTML and JavaScript. And he told me, now with Cursor, I can code so many things, like, and we don't need that many features anymore, so maybe we don't need a developer. So that was a big reason why we let him go. So I guess that was the same for you. So you're saying that you halved your team mostly because AI kind of streamlined the whole process. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That's scary.
It is scary.
It's scary, yeah.
I have a question for you. Like, how do you think about your team? Well, I guess you just answered it. It's like, can it just be you and your co-founder for like, as, oh man, these reactions are crazy. Can it just be you and your co-founder, like, as far as you can see? Like, is there any reason that you would need to bring on like a lot more people?
That's a very good question. And I think it depends a bit on what are your ambition and how much you are willing to bet, right? So I think, yes, we could definitely use more people for mostly actually marketing and sales at the moment to scale PodSqueez up. The question is there enough money to be made to pay all of these people and still have like a revenue and pay a proper paycheck to all of us? And it's interesting here, because that's also a question I would eventually have for you, because you raised money, you went through the whole tiny seed situation, and that's something that I would also reverse back to you. Like, but to answer your question, I think it really depends on the ambition and how much you're willing to risk. But I can say that now it's just the two of us. We had before a bigger team, but now it's basically the two of us and ChatGPT, and we are able, I think we have more than 600 paying customers at the moment. We have from small to big, and everyone seems to be happy, right? So it seems to be scalable.
Yeah.
Now, the only thing that I noticed is that there's a lot of work, and there's definitely things we are not doing that we should be doing. Reaching out to more people, creating more content. But it's the 80-20 rule, right? So I think 20% brings 80% of the results. I think that's with the team of two, yes, that's what we're doing. But sure, I wouldn't mind kind of increasing the team a little bit. That's for sure.
So to answer your question about like, raising money. So we joined Tiny Seed. So Tiny Seed Accelerator Program. It's a 1 year. You come in, you get a little bit of money and you get a bunch of like mentorship and networking.
How long after starting your SARS you decided to join?
About a year, probably.
A year.
Yeah. Okay. So we were at like 10K MRR when we joined.
10K, right. Let me just close this chapter, because I think there's still maybe a few lessons, or at least I would like to summarize this.
Mm.
So you have an agency. From the agency, you found an opportunity. So you acquired this plugin, right? That was already having some traction. So what lessons can we take it? How can the listeners take some lessons and apply to them? So is it good to start first with an agency and then go for a SaaS? Or is it better to start right away from a SaaS? Do you think you had something to gain by starting as an agency?
Is it right? I don't know if you can say it's universally right to start with an agency or not, just because it's so different. Like, it depends on your personal situation. Like, if you're a technical person or a developer, probably not. Like, you probably have more opportunity to go build a product like SaaS. If you're not, it probably, like, the fastest way to make money is to start an agency or a product or service. So I think it depends on kind of your background, your goals, your skills, and your ambition, which path you take. These days, I think SaaS is in a weird place. So, like, specifically today, I don't think I would tell somebody to just go build SaaS, even if they're a developer. I certainly wouldn't tell someone to go build a $19 a month SaaS product, which, like, you and I know is, like, it's hard. It's hard to compete in this lower middle kind of class creator economy SaaS tool. So, like, if I was going to create SaaS as a first-time person, I would be targeting like $100 a month at least.
Okay.
If I was going to build another SaaS, it'd be like $1,000 a month, easy. Like, I would only sell enterprise stuff. But for listeners, like, yeah, I think basically if you can't build $100 a month SaaS, I would start an agency.
It's an agency is easier. I think an agency is easier than a SaaS.
Yeah.
For a starting entrepreneur, an agency is an easier path.
Okay. 100%.
And how does one, like, what are the skills you need to start an agency? Like, how, you had sales, you had a podcast, let's join these two together. Is that the recipe? Like, one thing that you're good at that you do, even if it's as an hobby, and then another and join and start selling that? Like, how do I identify the product you're selling as a service?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it is. Like, what do you know? And what can you sell? And do you have a network where you can go sell that thing?
Okay, so that's also an important part. Do you have the distribution? After 1 year, 10K MRR, which is quite amazing. But there was also a big investment, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think like the only reason we were able to do the SaaS is the productized service funded everything. So we were bootstrapped or self-funded for the first year. That's acquiring the plugin, paying the developer. You know, I wasn't making any money from the SaaS for the first year or two or three. Like, I think we can talk about that. I'm sure you can relate. But yeah, so the productized service or the agency let me quit my job. That's also when we moved to France.
Okay.
And acquire the plugin that let me build the SaaS. So, like, the agency model is just so fast at enabling you to do stuff and have options. I think that's the short version.
Yeah.
Whereas SaaS is like freaking a year to build the thing, and then you're only doing $1,000 a month, and you and your co-founder are spending 60 hours a week. And then at some point, SaaS is really great because, like, at the point where we're at or where you're at, it's like, hey, this is pretty cool. This is stable. We have a little bit of team. You know, things are pretty chill. It's just the first year. At least, unless you have some massive competitive advantage.
Totally. And when you're starting, right, your biggest struggle is money, right? You have the, especially as a bootstrapper, right? You need to pay your bills. So you have a runway, probably you saved some money. But if you don't, if you are not able to make money until the runway runs out, then you have to go back to a 9-to-5. So I like this idea of let's start with something easier. Let's start with kind of an agency, and then once you have money, then you're more chilled. Okay, now let's think about the next step. And you already have knowledge, you already have the distribution, and you go for a SaaS. So I think this is a great recipe for people starting out. So after a year, 10K, you decided to go through TinySeed. Can you explain a bit what is TinySeed?
Yeah, so TinySeed is an accelerator program. So you join, they give you some money in exchange for equity in your company. So actual like ownership in your company, not a lot, but some. And I had a lot of mentorship. So we were in the first cohort. So we had direct access to Rob Walling and Einar Volset, like the kind of founders of TinySeed. And there were 10 other companies in our cohort. Tiny Seed currently does cohorts twice a year, so like spring and fall.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the pitch kind of is it helps you bridge that gap we were talking about, right? Is like SaaS takes a year to get over this kind of hump to where you're self-sufficient. They give you money, resources, and time, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Money or time in the form of money to go full-time, hire a person, and really kind of go all in. And so,
what is the difference between Tiny Seed and any other kind of investment group or accelerator?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Tiny Seed will tell you, like, they're not the cheapest money, like the amount of equity they take for the amount of money they give you, or your valuation is not the cheapest. You could get money, you know, cheaper other places. But I think the value in Tiny Seed, as opposed to just a VC firm or whatever, is mentorship. So they have like an official program. Like you go through and you learn these things and the network. Like now there's 250 companies in Tiny Seed. And so like when I have a question, they're the most valuable group of people I can go to.
Got it.
There's somebody that is an absolute expert on LinkedIn ads or programmatic SEO or cybersecurity or, you know, freaking Claude Code and all these like AI dev tool stuff. Like there's someone who, or sales, like there's someone who's an expert on everything. So like that's the biggest value these days. When we started, it was just money. And like someone like Rob and Einar being on our side.
Do you have like a WhatsApp group or like a Telegram group where everyone is in and you can just like send the question and they will answer?
Slack. Yeah.
Slack. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I miss that a lot. I miss like this. That's the kind of thing you don't have on Twitter, especially people that are, you know, they have knowledge and they are going through the same thing. So yeah, I can definitely see the value on that.
Yep.
What are the biggest things that you have learned through this process? Like what were things that, I guess before that, was it worth it? Do you think would you recommend other founders to go through the same, go through Tiny Seed? Or yeah, and what were the biggest things you have learned from this whole process?
Is it worth it and what have I learned are definitely different questions. So like what have I learned is that distribution is like everything, right? There are SaaS companies doing very well with 8% churn. And there are SaaS companies that are not growing with 2% churn. And so when you think about like, oh, the product is the most important thing, or our customer support is amazing, like, yeah, that's cool. But that's just not going to grow a massive company. Like massive companies, 100% of them have amazing marketing and sales. So like that's one counterintuitive thing that is hard for, I think, technical founders especially to really grasp, is like your skill set isn't the most important one. You know, like you building a slightly better version of PodSqueeze is not going to double your MRR. You creating a slightly better marketing system or content marketing or Twitter presence or whatever, yep, that could double your MRR. So I think that's something I kind of like always knew, but from my journey and then seeing 200 other companies come through now, that's the pattern. It is like the best founders figure out sales and marketing.
And do you learn how to do that through Tiny Seed?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, they do everything they can, right? It's like their approach is very much like, you know, there's the expression like teach a man to fish and he'll never be hungry a day in his life. Like they don't just give you fish, they teach you to fish. So they teach you the principles of sales and marketing and positioning and pricing and hiring and all that kind of stuff. So like they very much want to equip you with the tools you need to go be successful. Their job is not to run the company for you.
Got it.
Yeah.
How much time did it take from your day to day, from your business? Like, you know, because you at this point, two kids, right?
Yeah.
So there's family, and how much time would you spend? Was it days where your family wouldn't see you, or is it somehow chilled?
But like the business in general or Tiny Seed?
Both, because you're doing both, right? Like you still had your agency, right? Like both things.
Yeah. Yeah.
You still have it, right? That is still running.
Still. Yep.
The agency. So you have an agency, you have a SaaS, you have a family, and now you are through Tiny Seed. Like,
yeah.
Tell me about those days. Was it crazy, or were you able to balance everything out?
You know, like living in France, it was actually really great.
And living in France, yeah.
Yeah, it was really great because a lot of days I would like do a little bit of work in the morning which was really chill, like quiet time. A lot of our team, and especially now, or even now, about half our team is in Europe. And that just kind of has our roots from me living there. And right. So our team was our developers in South Africa. So most of the time on the same time zone, most of the year on the same time zone as me. So a lot of times I would go do work in the morning and I would take a big chunk of the middle of the day off to go have, you know, the classic like 2-hour lunch with my wife and then come back and work from like 3 to 8 or something.
Okay.
And so, yeah, that was pretty cool. I mean, I really embraced kind of async work a lot in terms of time. You know, the agency kind of largely ran itself. I would just do sales. That was fine. But we had people, you know, taking care of the customers and the day-to-day stuff. And they would always have like the occasional question or something. But at that point, we had pretty good systems for the agency. The SaaS took quite a bit of time in terms of like communicating about product and like coordinating marketing. And then Tiny Seed would take like a few hours a week. So they would have, I'll explain how it is now. So they have like video modules. So you go watch this video and then they have a live call to kind of do Q&A and like debrief on the topic. And then there's a lot of kind of async stuff in Slack about like, hey, I'm facing this problem. What about it? So, you know, it's like a handful of hours a week.
It's like almost like a course. You're going through, you're learning how to become a better entrepreneur, right?
Yeah. Yeah. As I was describing that, it's like, wow, this sounds a lot like a course. It's just like so much more. Like, I don't think a course is a fair term, but yeah, the things you would do in a course are the things that Tiny Seed provides are similar. Yeah. But yeah.
Course, mentorship, and money, right? So right. All of this aspects.
And network, yeah.
And network, yeah. So yeah. You, back then, you raised this money. I'm curious about this. So bootstrappers, this is a question, by the way, that I get a lot. Like, are you hoping to raise? Did you raise money? It's always an answer that I normally, it's more towards the no, but it's not all the way towards no because maybe it helps. You know, we grew up learning about the VC and Facebooks and these unicorns that were raising millions, and that's the way out on how to make companies. So you actually did that, right? So you bootstrapped and you raised money. Tell me, how did you use that money, first of all? And yeah, how helpful it was to especially to take Castos to the next level.
Yeah. So it was massively helpful. Like it let us take one of our developers full-time and hire a full-time marketing person with this money. And I started paying myself a little bit. I think the question of like, when do you raise money and how should you raise money and all that kind of stuff is like, one, it's really personal. It's like, do you want a business that you control entirely, or do you want to go big and maybe have a really big opportunity for a big exit? Like one thing for sure, the first time you raise or the second that you raise money, your goal is to exit the business as fast as possible for as much money as you can. And so if that's not your goal, definitely don't raise money. Also, if you have this kind of like allergic reaction to someone else having a voice in your business, then definitely don't raise money. One thing I definitely understood, but it just hasn't played out this way, is when you raise money, you change the trajectory and the goal line of the business a little bit. So when you raise, say you go, not Tiny Seed, say you go raise, especially like venture capital, that's the most extreme version. The only goal of the business is to be a $1 billion business. So what you want doesn't matter anymore, right? Like that's the goal. It's like you have to be the next Airbnb or you're a failure. And so how you live your life, how you run the business, all this stuff is like, that's the goal. Tiny Seed is not that. And you know, other ways you can raise money are not that, but they're not, you know, hey, I'm a bootstrapper. This is an indie thing. If I just decide I'm tired of this tomorrow and I want to shut it down and go be a, you know, whatever YouTuber, you're talking about Minecraft all day, you can do that. You just have to work it out with your co-founder. And like, similarly, when you want to go sell your business, you have to consider like, hey, is this the right thing for my shareholders and my investors? Because it's not just you anymore. Right. And so like, that's why I always say, like, people ask me this question about like raising money. First of all, it's a personal decision. Like, is this what you want? Like, do you want to forsake some of your independence and your optionality for money and time and leverage to build a bigger business? And the answer for me was yes. And it was the right decision. It's not always the right decision for everybody in every situation, though.
Okay. I like it. So it's something very personal. It's something that's you need to meditate on and think, okay, what do I need? What do I want?
Yeah.
Because as you just described, it's very different, right? So the goal is different. So one thing is if you sell your business for 1 million and you are two, each one of you have also, you know, earns half a million, and that's already quite good. You know, that's half, you know, kind of life-changing money. But if you raise money, then you need to sell for 10 million or 20 million. So it might be, I guess most people will not even get there. So you might just lose it all, right? So you're trying to get bigger, but eventually, you know, chances are that you might not do it. So, and that's exactly what I realized. And that's also why we decided not to do it so far. But I'm happy that it worked out for you. And so you believe that without raising money, Castus would not be in the same position as it is now.
Yeah, 100%. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So you got to hire people, you got to work, I guess, in your marketing, and that definitely made a difference. So you also raised money you raised the second round after that, right?
We did. Yeah. So 2 years, 2.5 years after we joined Tiny Seed, we raised an extra $750,000 from a combination of like a couple of companies and individuals.
Got it. And that was it still as productive as the first round?
In a way, yeah. So the kind of thesis when we joined Tiny Seed was like, hey, we just need this to get alive. You know, we were, you know, bootstrapped and whatever, but
right.
But like, hey, this can help us grow faster. When we raised money the second time, it was, hey, we think we can go to the enterprise and sell like big $30,000 a year deals. Because we had sold one deal, it came inbound, and we're like, hey, let's just go do more of this.
Yeah.
And so we raised money, we hired a sales team, we brought on extra marketing people, we hired another developer, started building out like a mobile app and all this kind of stuff. We ultimately weren't as successful as we wanted to be. We definitely grew, but not like, you know, a rocket ship, because we just haven't found, and still to this day, a great way to find our ICP, basically. Companies who want internal podcasting solutions that are really robust and secure, mobile first, all this kind of stuff. Like, it's just not a huge market. We haven't found a way to identify them at the right point in their kind of buying journey. And so we just haven't been able to grow as fast as, mm-hmm. as we want. You know, like someone asked me, like, do I regret it? Definitely not. Like, we took a bet and we took a swing and we tried. And I learned a ton. Like, I learned a ton about like raising money and hiring people and enterprise mm-hmm. sales and SaaS. Cause like my sales experience wasn't in SaaS before. So like I learned a lot about sales. Directly, I think the thing that in hindsight I would say for anybody listening is like you hit the nail on the head, which is like when you raise that kind of money, the goal isn't to sell for $2 million, it's to sell for $20 million.
Right.
And I didn't fully grasp that at the time. It's funny because like we were raising money and we were going to raise like $500,000 because we had a commit from Automattic. Automattic was one of our investors. The like parent company of WordPress. And then we were going to raise the rest from individuals. And we reached like the amount we wanted to raise, which was like a lot less than 750. And people still wanted to pile on. And I was like, yeah, we'll just raise as much as we can. Like, why not? Yeah. And what I didn't realize is like, I realized, but I didn't really kind of grok it, I guess, is like, one, those people get paid back no matter what. So like if you raise $1 million and you go sell the business for $1 million, you get nothing.
They get the money first.
They get the money first. It's not like, oh, they own 5%. So if you sell for $1 million, they get, you know, whatever it is.
5% of that. Yeah, that's important. I don't think a lot of people know that, right? That first the investors get the money, then you'll get the money.
Yeah.
Right? So it might be that you get zero.
Yeah. And you see this with like ultra VC stuff a lot. is like, oh, you know, there have been stories, I don't remember, you know, specifically, but like, oh, this person sold a $1 billion company and lost money. Like 100%, 100% that can happen. So like the thing I would tell folks is like, if you're looking at raising money, you have to consider the magnitude of the opportunity. Like, and that probably is the math that you guys did. It's like, can you be a $20 million a year company? I don't think you can. I don't think you can be a $20 million a year company. So you shouldn't raise money. In hindsight, I don't think Castos can be a $20 million a year company either. So we shouldn't have raised money.
That's exactly the math we did. We looked at like the podcasting market and we thought like, yeah, how do we get there? Like, and we did the same reasoning, like, okay, we have B2B clients, maybe we can get there's, and maybe we definitely can get more than what we're having now, but yeah, can we get to this, you know, 10 million, 20 million and realize not with this market? I don't think that's possible.
Yeah.
And, but I think, yeah, that's definitely a great way to look at it. And yeah, so I'm happy. I think somehow we made the right decision. Now we could take micro investment, like the one you took from Tiny Seed, and there it would be different, right? So maybe you can raise 100K, 200K, and that's already enough for you to try a bunch of things you want to try and still be enough so that you can kind of get some money.
Yeah.
Once you sell it. But it's definitely a great insight here to share with the listeners. Tell me about this podcasting market. So where do you think it's going? I mean, there are definitely some frustrations, right? So one of the biggest frustrations for me is what we call in the industry the pod fade, right? So the percentage of people that don't pass episode number 3 and they eventually give up, and that also increases churn quite a bit. Is that something that you also face? This pod fade churn, something that it frustrates you in this industry?
Yeah. I mean that's definitely a concern. I think that, you know, to my question or point at the beginning is like, it's a fundamental difference in our business models. Is if somebody gets to episode 3 and then stops their podcast, they may still pay Castos for another year or 2 or 3. They won't pay you anymore. And so that's like a fundamental difference. I think that the flip side of that is it's really easy to get value from PodSqueeze. You just sign up, put in your RSS feed or whatever it is, and like you get value, right? You get your stuff. With us, it's like you got
to freaking create the podcast. And it's easy to move through platforms.
Right. So you have higher
churn. It's much harder to move.
Yep. Yeah. Low switching cost. Mm-hmm. You know, with us, it's like you got to sign up and you got to create your podcast and you got to edit it and you got to, you know, previously you got to freaking have an Apple Podcast Connect account or whatever. Like we've made that like literally just one click. We distribute for our customers. So you don't even have to understand that stuff. You literally just click a button and it goes to like the 10 most popular directories. But previously, that was a massive hurdle for customers. But I think this is a universal thing. It's not just the podcasting industry. Is you can have either. And they each have their benefits and they each have their drawbacks, right? You can have a really sticky product that delivers value consistently, even if the customers don't use it, which is us. Mm-hmm. But it's tough to get people onboarded. Or you can have a really easy product, and a lot of the AI products probably fall in this boat, that it's easy to get immediate value. It has very low switching costs, though, and probably has higher churn. So you're able to get a lot of top of funnel easier, but then you lose out at the bottom of the funnel through churn and just pod fade and people just not podcasting anymore.
Right.
So we survey all of our customers that cancel, and there's two reasons people cancel Castos. That's 97% of our cancellations. I'm not podcasting anymore.
Yeah.
And it's too expensive.
Mm. Yes. I'm not using the product enough and I'm not podcasting anymore. It's definitely something that we get a lot.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So how do you fix that? Like what is the solution? Like I can tell it from my side, the only solution we are getting is that we need to increase prices. We need to accept our subscriber churn and try to reduce our revenue churn. So the ones that stick with us, they just need to pay more to compensate for the ones that loses. This is kind of our mindset at the moment.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about what is your solution for this?
I don't know entirely is the answer. We We are very fortunate, and I know other hosting companies that don't experience this. We have extremely low churn, like 2%.
That is incredible.
Yeah. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, we have a really great product. We have an amazing support team. We have two full-time support people, which in the era of AI is like a lot. But it's because we want them to just obsess over keeping customers, because we think it's one of the easiest ways to grow the business is just not have churn. We don't have to have as big a top of funnel. So product, support, and marketing. We don't market that we're a very cheap product. I think other people in our space do. You know, there's free plans. There's $5 a month plans, which I think is insane. We're $19 a month, which puts us right at the kind of top of the, you know, majority of the market.
Right.
And so I think we signal like, hey, we're a really premium product. And so I think like for the kind of B to prosumer world that we both live in, like that's kind of how we've identified this. We do have enterprise customers. They're pretty tough to find in our experience. But yeah, aside that, I don't have the answer. Like, I don't have the answer for like, you do this thing and get a whole bunch more customers. Like the thing that we did for a long time was content marketing and SEO. That's just really, I mean,
it plateaus. Does it plateau at some point? Because for us, it's still like where we bring this the most traffic, but it kind of plateaus for after a while, and there's no more keywords to rank, and
exactly.
It's hard to get to those for certain keywords. It's hard to get to the top.
Yep. So exactly. I mean, we're, you know, honestly, like we've been kind of, I'll say, seeing diminishing returns for like a long time, even before AI, because we just invested so much in content marketing for so long. Like we ranked for all the terms we reasonably thought we could. It's where now, like we're looking at, like, hey, can we market on Reddit? Can we do a better job with affiliates? Can we be more involved in the community? Can we lean into our WordPress positioning and get more customers from there? Like, I think it's one of these things where like, okay, you go get the big obvious thing. That's the real big win. That's like, clearly you should do this. When you do that, then you have to move and say like, what's the next thing to do? Like, I don't, you know, maybe you don't know, or it's not going to be as good as the first one, because you chose the first one, content marketing, for a lot of people, because it was really obvious. So what's the next one? Like, I don't know. Maybe we should like cold email all the Libsyn customers and ask them to come over and give them 3 months free. Like, that would probably work. I don't know.
How do you manage that? It's you reach a certain point, and I've done this with my co-founder so many times. Like, we go through everything. Like, oh, maybe SEO again. Like, we have done this. Okay, maybe Reddit. Oh, yeah, okay. And at some point, we realize, man, we are in the loop. We have tried everything. Yeah. And now we have tried everything 3 times, 4 times. And you just realize it's the market. Like, you reached, you know, when you have a coffee shop, like, you don't expect to always sell more coffees and more. No, you have like a neighborhood, and that's how many coffees you can sell. So I guess the same can apply to SaaS. Now, the question is, for a bootstrapper, what do you do next? You just enjoy, you just retire, you sell, you start something else, and you keep this one running? Like, or do you just keep trying and trying and trying and sending cold emails to Libsyn and like,
how do you deal with that? I'll say that none of those options are wrong. So, okay, I'll give the bland, boring answer that none of those answers are wrong. I will say what I have learned, because we have kind of like, in my mind, kind of like gone over the top of the hill, right? Like, podcasting was growing, the pandemic, like we all grew like crazy. Podcasting is like relatively flat now, and us and a bunch of our competitors are kind of finding growth hard these days. Like, a lot of stuff has changed. The marketing channel that has brought us all of our customers is really different, at least in like SEO. And so an answer is, we should have sold 3 years ago.
I love the answer.
That probably is the thing. And so like, well, I say
why,
that
why
for,
didn't you?
Partly because we raised money, and I thought like, we got to get to 10 million to make this worth it for everybody. So that is like, when you raise money, that goal moves, that goalpost moves. It's not a million, it's 5 million or 10 million. But one thing that I have come to appreciate and accept just in the last few months is there are certain like caliber of founders that are extremely discerning about how they spend their time. and they don't accept an average situation like at all. And like, just to put it plainly, I think podcasting as a market is a pretty average market, or maybe even below average. And so any opportunity that you and I have in the podcasting market is not great, as opposed to we could have built Cursor, right? We could have gone and built the next Cursor. We could have gone and built, you know, some amazing thing. But we're in a market that, like you said, with your coffee shop analogy, is just capped. It's only so big. People are only willing to spend so much money. And so I think if you want to consider evolving and leveling up as a founder, one of the first things that you should do is be a lot more critical and discerning about just the business and the business model and the market that you're in, because it dictates so much of what you can do.
So evaluate the size of the market, evaluate how much money there is, how much, really do the calculations on
how much people are willing to spend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then just accept it, right? I think that's at some point you just need to accept that there's not more growth, or if there is, the growth is not that growth that, you know, hockey stick type of growth, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Accept it. And then that means like one of a few things, you know, just accept it and it's chill and you're just going to run this business for a while. Accept it and sell, or just shut it down and go do something else.
Right. I mean, it's always better to sell, right, than just shut it down.
Yeah,
I guess.
But or don't enter the market, right? If you're looking at this from the outside, you're hearing two people in the podcasting space saying like, "Hey, it's pretty tough. Probably don't start another podcasting company."
Yeah, but it's interesting because in kind of the beginning of the conversation, you said if I would do it all over again, I would go to $1,000 subscription, and I think everyone would love to do that. The question is it something that you reckon to be easy? To find a product in, and we are getting a bit also into the AI world where like the competition it's very fierce and there's so many people, so many products, it's so easy to make products.
Yeah.
Is it something that one can easily accomplish to build something that companies are willing to pay $1,000 per subscription per month?
No, definitely not. Yeah. No, but I think the kind of return on investment is outsized in that respect, because at $1,000 a month, you have zero churn. Basically, you're going to have, you know, really high customer lifetime value. $1,000 is like the floor. You'll probably sell $5,000 or $10,000 a month deals. The problem you solve for those customers is massive. And so they'll come looking for your solution. But no, I think it's extremely hard to find that, you know, $10,000 a month or a year kind of problem to solve.
Mm-hmm. What is the, and kind of as we're getting close to the end of our conversation, I'm curious about, I'm not sure if this is something that you think about starting something new, but if you do, let's make this exercise.
Mm.
You're starting something new. And what is the recipe? What are you going to look for in the markets? Like the size of the market, the type of products, what is the recipe for another product for Craig?
So it would definitely be B2B. You know, I would want to sell directly to companies. And I think even selling to like founders and executives is not like what we're talking about. You know, you see a lot of this like founder to founder marketing. And I think that's kind of like just a slightly better version of what we do, which is like creator to creator,
yeah.
Or, you know, B to prosumer.
So how big are these companies that you're selling to?
Yeah, like thousands of employees.
Okay.
So if I were to get into SaaS again, it would be that. I think SaaS would probably be my third option of a business model. I don't know the answer of like what I would do. I think SaaS would be my third option.
What would be the first two?
My first one would be, I think that some type of, you know, you mentioned like Tiny Seed training course program community is, from a business model perspective, really appealing. It can just be you.
It is?
You can have, yeah, I think it is. It can just be you. You can have a pretty simple business model. You can have a single channel and you can have extremely high margins. And you don't have dependency on anybody else. Like I have dependency on developers and AWS and all this kind of crap. with a model like that? I think you don't. I think AI is disrupting that a lot, because the benefit of that was, you know, I as a person have specialized knowledge that nobody else has. That just doesn't exist anymore. So the value prop of this changes a little bit. But I think a lot of coaching and programs is a psychological thing. It's not the actual thing you want to get. It's how you feel about the situation you're in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that will always be the case, and maybe even more so with AI, right? Like AI knowledge is everywhere, and maybe there's too much knowledge to where you just need a human to talk to sift through all the crap. I mean, I was listening to Nathan Berry's podcast, and he had on Chris Donnelly doing $10 million a year, selling like a cohort program. Like, of course, he's the 1%, but you look at some of those folks, like, that's a pretty good business. Could I pull that off? I don't know.
Yeah, that's the question. It seems very hard to get there. Once you get there, it's awesome.
Yeah,
it's like an info product, like selling an info product. Once you get the book that everyone wants to buy, that's the best business, because, you know, just selling and selling.
Yeah.
But to get there, you need to build the whole audience and everything.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I did not expect that would be your third option. About AI. So what? How can someone think? And I get anxious about this, right? We spoke about this. It seems that we are always one release away from OpenAI to lose our business, to lose our job, to lose our authenticity. SaaS founders, like, how can you have AI, include AI into the equation of the future of SaaS and not be afraid of eventually losing the race to AI?
Yeah, so I, like 2 months ago, I was really afraid of AI, really afraid of what it would do to myself and my life and my business and just the economy and the world. It's changed a lot. I started doing a bunch of content around AI. So I'm doing this whole like 100 days of AI on YouTube. I'm publishing a video every day for 100 days. I published day 41 today, I think. And the mindset shift is like, I think AI is probably going to wreck the world, right? I think what's probably going to happen is we're going to get like 20% unemployment. Like, you see it already in the US, like the jobs report came out a few days ago. And it's just like this, like nobody's hiring and a bunch of people are laying people off, just like we talked about before. And so what's going to happen is a bunch of people are going to get laid off. And so the thing I don't worry about is AI disrupting podcast hosting or, you know, content, you know, repurposing like you guys do. The thing that could wreck my business is our customers not having jobs.
Whoa, that took a dark turn.
Yeah, like that's probably what's going to happen. And there's nothing I can do about that, right? It's not like I can't make the best podcast hosting ever or the best community or the best marketing or whatever. And so what I'm doing is saying like, hey, I want to get myself like on the AI bandwagon as much as possible. So I'm knowledgeable. You know, I have like an audience and I have, you know, options, at least so I know what's going on, because AI is 100% happening and it's going to disrupt everything, whether it's directly, you know, ChatGPT releasing something that basically makes your service irrelevant or a duplicate.
Absolute, yeah.
Or just it reshapes the economy. So there's nothing you can do about it other than have a plan B.
I mean, what I thought, okay, we need to create something that AI will not replace. I think, I think creativity, like creating a podcast, even though you can create podcasts using only AI, people still like humans. You know, I always give this analogy with chess. Like, there's no human can beat the chess algorithm these days, but people still watch, you know, humans play each other. And of course, if you go to more analog businesses like restaurants and stuff like that. So I often think about this. Maybe I should start investing in something like this. But, and you're absolutely right, if people don't have jobs, they cannot buy my burgers, right? Like,
yeah,
that's a great perspective. Something, another thing to give me nightmares, I guess, this night, because that's absolutely true. Yeah.
So we were talking about business models and like if I did something else. So the first one would be some sort of like cohort-based program. The third one would be SaaS, but the second one would be some kind of local business. So we have some guys working on our house. There's like an electrician here. you know, electricians, yeah. plumbers, people to like repave driveways. Like, it will be the last thing that AI and robot, like, it's really robotics that would replace that, but we're a decade yeah. at least away. And so, like, what would I do to really AI proof myself is, you know, go buy a couple dumpsters and rent them out or something. Like, I think that's a pretty good bet, because people will have to live somewhere and will continue to spend money on their house.
That is smart. That is definitely something to consider. Last question, and it's just because I really want to get your opinion on this, even though it's a bit different than what we're talking about. Difference. You lived in France, you live in Europe, you lived in US. Difference of business mindsets. So why is that in the US is the biggest economy and it's much more business driven, and it seems that you guys are much more successful in a lot of ways in terms of business. You lived in both worlds. I need to know what are things, if you could like take some of your American business mindset and give it to Europeans, what would that be?
So I think the biggest single difference is, and I think most Europeans would agree with this, most Europeans lack confidence to just go do something. Like, you are really rare to just start a company and be online and do all this kind of stuff. And in the US, it is not that big a deal to be like, I fucking quit my job and I'm going to go start a landscaping company tomorrow and I'll just figure it out. That is not a European mindset. We're generalizing hugely, but I think that's like that's the fundamental difference. And I think it probably goes all the way back to like the first people here were like, I don't really know. We're just going to go west and see what happens. And like it worked out for them, you know, maybe. And I think
you think it's a cultural thing.
I think it's a cultural thing. Is like we could just send like a car into space, like be just because we can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So,
which is so interesting because from a societal perspective, you and Europeans have all of the built-in safety net. You have colleges paid for, you have healthcare, you have, you know, social security and pension and retirement. You have all of the stuff that is the huge risk of leaving a company to do stuff on your own. In the US is like, you don't have any of that stuff. So it always blew my mind. And it's probably why the UK is such a good blend, because they have all the social infrastructure and support and more of the entrepreneurial mindset.
Mm-hmm. Because the issue, maybe not in Portugal so much, but especially if you go to Germany and so on, is that it's actually very comfortable to be an employee.
Yeah.
So it's very rare, I believe, especially if you're a developer, at least back in the days, to create a business that will pay you more and give you more time and a better life than,
that's the other part,
than you know, just working for others, right? So I think the safety net in that sense can be bad because you have more to lose. In Portugal, it's easier because the working for others here is terrible. So the salaries are worse and so on. But yeah, I totally agree. I totally understand that. I think now that I've done this step, I don't feel it anymore. But especially in the beginning, people were like, my family is like, what are you doing? Like, why are you quitting your job? Like, don't do that. That's a huge mistake.
Yeah.
And now it's a given for me and people don't question it anymore because that's a huge superpower because you realize, wow, I did this and it worked, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a lovely way and to finish this conversation. Craig, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Tell
thank
us
you.
About your podcast. Where can people follow you and listen more about your amazing business advice?
Yeah. So my podcast is called Rogue Startups. So roguestartups.com. You can check it out there. The place where I'm publishing most of my content these days is on YouTube, and just search for Craig Hewitt on YouTube. It's all about AI these days, but I have quite a bit on like sales, marketing, and running a business. And yeah, that's the best place to find me.
Awesome. And if the listeners like to listen to this podcast, they'll definitely love Rogue Startups because it's in the same genre. Also speaking about bootstrapping, also speaking about entrepreneurship. Thank you very much, Craig.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And that's the end of my conversation with Craig. I hope you enjoyed this content and you have learned as much as I did. Now, if you want to continue, I recommend listening to episode 334, where I interview Rob Walling. He is the founder of Tiny Seed, the accelerator that Greg went through, and he shares a lot of knowledge, both from starting his own company, but as well from working with dozens of other entrepreneurs. That's episodes 334. If you like this type of content, make sure to give it a review and a thumbs up if you're listening to this on YouTube. And there is another episode coming up next Monday. Every Monday, there's another episode of the Indie Father podcast. So until then, keep shipping.